This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, both professors of law at Yale Law School, and they are the author of a new book, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. Amy, Jed, welcome to Berkeley. Let's talk about the data set you're using. Your book is about the rise and fall of groups, and you talk a great deal about cultural groups. What do you mean by cultural groups?
The groups we're focusing on are religious, national origin, or ethnic groups. And groups of that kind can often be, but aren't always, cultural groups in the sense that they tend to be united by and pass on a certain set of outlooks or experiences or cultural values to their kids. But the basic definition of the group that we're working with is religious, national origin, or ethnic. And so some of the groups we look at, for example, Mormons, religious group, Cuban Americans, national origin. I wouldn't call that ethnic, would you? Chinese Americans, that's more of an ethnic, you know, there's so many places that Chinese Americans come from, so it's not exactly national origin. So those are the kinds of groups.
And how did you go about choosing the groups that are in your data set?
Oh, well, so the book's starting point is a remarkable fact about America today, a seemingly un-American fact, which is that for some groups, much more than the rest of the country, their members and their kids are experiencing upward mobility at dramatically high rates, also educational attainment. You know, it's a very tough economy, we all know that, shrinking opportunity, rising inequality, and yet the fact is that there are these groups out there who are experiencing upper mobility at higher rates. Now, there are many such groups. In fact, there are literally dozens of groups outperforming the national average. But what we did is we spent months looking at census data and all the available economic data to try to single out a number of groups to focus on. We could have looked at dozens of groups. We didn't have a big enough book for that. But we tried to find groups that were about the five arguably most strikingly successful of the groups outperforming. Now, we did some things like we eliminated groups with fewer than 100,000 members. They're just too small. We picked larger ones. The census, it's interesting now. The census is not permitted to ask questions about religion anymore. So that for the income and economic performance of religious groups, you have to look elsewhere. But the census asks people about their national origin and their ethnicity, but that can produce strange results. So there's about a million or so Americans who identify themselves as British, and the census will tell you that their incomes are very, very high. But then there's 25 million Americans who identify themselves as English by background, whose incomes are much lower. It would be fascinating if we could have separated that out, tried to figure out what was going on there. We couldn't. So we eliminated that group. What we couldn't understand the difference between British and English Americans. Maybe someday somebody will. But we ended up with five groups that are arguably, by all the census tracked economic data, the most strikingly successful. Although we could have picked others, Indian Americans, whose median household income is almost double the national figure, Persian Americans, Iranian Americans, Lebanese Americans, Jewish Americans, and Chinese Americans. Then we also looked at Mormons, because Mormons are, in some sense, the most upwardly mobile of any of the groups out there that we looked at. So just 30 years ago, it was still very hard to find a Mormon on Wall Street. And we know this from personal experience. I worked on Wall Street in the early 80s. Now, a remarkable number of Mormons are the CEOs or CFOs of some of America's most well-known corporations. This is a fascinating phenomenon. It's out there. A lot of people know about it. So we included them for that reason. We also included Nigerian Americans and Cuban Americans. Nigerian Americans are extraordinary in the disproportionate success and educational achievement they're attaining, especially relative to the rest of America's African-American population. So Nigerian-Americans are a tiny percentage of the U.S. black population, but they are almost 25% of a Harvard Business School student body, really remarkable, and Cuban Americans have achieved a great deal since they started coming here after 1959.
Now in going after this topic, to what extent were you affected by your own stories, basically? Does that enter into this equation?
Well, we have, for years, ever since our kids were little, noticed that we're from, well, totally different cultures. He's Jewish American, I'm Chinese American. So we're totally different, yet we have so many similarities. And I used to say that, you know, I think Chinese Americans are just three generations behind the Jews. Because if you look at Jewish Americans from you know, the turn of the century, the behaviors are actually very similar to new Chinese immigrants now. You know, you have to be a doctor, you have to get straight A's, play these classical instruments.
But also in the preface, I think you point out that you were noticing things in your classes at Yale, an elite school, the cream of the cream.
That's essentially, we started noticing, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, very striking demographic patterns. Suddenly, just it seemed a lot of Mormon students. Mm-hmm. You know, in one class, Jed taught 16 students, I think three of them were Mormons. I had one Asian American, we have lots of Asian American students. It seems like a lot of South Asian students, very high number of Persian American students. And we kind of wanted to, by the way, it's not just Nigerian. Out of 18 students that were in our Yale Law School Black Student Association, only two of them were non-immigrant. So we had Jamaicans, Ethiopians, Liberians, and we just thought, you know, let's see if this is at all representative. Or is this just something weird about Yale? Or is this true at a broader level, too? And that's when we put together the 50 research assistants, got out the census tables, went straight down, and discovered that it's actually representative in some ways. What's true of Yale is in some ways representative of the larger country.
Now, the data that you're looking at is very focused on a particular time. Let's talk about that. So you're not saying that these groups you've identified, that what you're saying is true through many generations.
You're exactly right about that, and it's something that we can't emphasize more. Mm-hmm. We took a snapshot. In fact, the data is from 2010. If we had looked 20 years earlier, we would have found different groups. If we had looked 20 years from now, we would find different groups. One of the most striking findings we came upon in our whole research was that Asian Americans who are doing so well academically today, Asian American students, for example, get SAT scores 140 points higher on average than the rest of the country, not a stereotype, a fact. But when researchers dug closer, they found that third-generation Asian Americans, that there was no difference in their academic performance between them and the rest of the country, proving that it's not innate, it's not biological, and it's an example of how this group's success dissipates after two generations, very fluid and dynamic. We think the traits that explain it remain the same, but the identity of the groups changed dramatically over time.
And in your one of your footnotes, which I should say that your book is extremely well documented with 100 pages of footnotes, and I don't say that I read every footnote, but this caught my eye. Cultures, and we're talking now about the groups you're looking at, cultures orient people in time, urging them, for example, to venerate the past, live for the moment, or direct themselves to the future. So time is a factor with all of these groups.
We think it's central. I mean, what is it that culture does? It does many things. It inculcates different habits, different outlooks. But if you kind of step back, one of the things it does is it orients people temporally in time to in the ways that I was describing the sentence that you just quoted. And what we found to be this overall, the kind of explanatory force behind the drive and success of these groups, which are successful now at this moment, it's a snapshot, is that they are oriented toward foregoing present satisfaction, just doing what you feel like now, and instead they endure hardship, they sacrifice, they are willing to work hard all for the sake of future gains. That is somehow what's being instilled in them when they're kids, is a desire to achieve in future which is strong enough so that they forego present satisfactions. And I think very much that's a culturally transmitted phenomenon.
Now, before we talk about the triple package, which is your descriptive analysis of these groups caught in time, I think we should point out that in your book, there's an interface between these groups and the society. And later, we're going to talk about some of your criticisms of American society. But you say the success of the triple package, which we'll talk about in a minute, requires a society with an institutional structure that rewards hard work and deferred gratification. So these immigrant groups interface with aspects of our society that are still present, and that's what really makes it all work.
That's what makes it all work. That's why this book is not a comparison between countries. You know, some people have responded to our book with the following kind of question. Well, if you're saying that, you know, Indian culture is so great or Chinese culture is so great, why is India a mess? That's, I'm just quoting from a question that was put in.
Fareed Zakaria.
So, the answer is that that's not the kind of argument we're making. What makes one nation more prosperous or successful than another is its institutions. Does it have politically inclusive institutions, democracy? Does it have a flourishing free market with all the legal protections and property protections that requires? So you have to have those institutions. We have institutions that aren't perfect by any means, but we have strong institutions of that kind in America. Without those institutions, none of this would work, as you say. It's a combination of the qualities that we're talking about with the institutions that produces success.
So you have the data. You have your own experiences. You have what you're seeing in your law school classes. So what then do you come up with? It's a triple package, you call it. Let's work through each one of those. First is the superiority complex.
Right. So our process of thinking was, okay, so we tried to isolate, in I think a really systematic way, the most strikingly successful groups at this point in time, in this snapshot, you know. And we said, what do these groups have in common? And we found, actually quite strikingly, that every one of them in some ways shared three qualities, but the first of which is what we call a superiority complex. And I will say that we deliberately chose a slightly negative tone. We could have said confidence or something. But by this, we mean a sense of exceptionality. And so, for example, the Jews, they practically define the concept of the chosen people. And I think today it's no longer religious-based. In fact, a lot of Jews are very uncomfortable with that idea. But certainly, you know, there's at every Passover Seder, young children hear about Jews as the chosen people. Even if it's not religious, there's an idea, well, we were a people of survivors, a people of intellect, a people of morality. This idea. Mormons have very much borrowed this chosen people idea. They actually have a Moses, they have an Exodus, and in addition to the chosen people narrative, you know, it's quite, they don't believe in original sin, and they have also a very strong sense of almost moral superiority. They describe themselves, you know, clean-cut values. Now that polygamy is gone, they can turn the tables on America and say, we're the more moral ones. And, you know, rest of America is a sea of moral decay, and we're an island of morality. And in these, we go through the groups, Iranian Americans, the Persian superiority complex is actually famous. Middle Eastern scholars talk about that. Iranian Americans themselves actually often distinguish themselves. We are not Arabs. We speak Farsi. Cuban Americans, similarly, strong sense of exceptionality. We are not like the rest of Hispanic America. And I mention those two because that highlights one of the dangers of the superiority complex. This ethnic pride can shade into intolerance. And I'll just say with the Chinese and Indian superiority complexes, this highlights what Jed was explaining about our usage of culture. We're not using culture in a kind of essentialist way, like, you know, China, Confucianism, only people born to the Middle Kingdom can have this. It's really much more an interplay. Who from China is coming over and what happens when they hit American society? And actually, in both these cases, there is developed for Indian Americans and Chinese Americans a sense of exceptionality based on we're better at working hard, we're better at excelling academically, and that becomes part of their identity, and it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And you say at one point, in comparing these groups, because their experiences are different, you say that this superiority complex is either rooted in theology, history, or imported social hierarchies. So some of these people, you can think of the Iranians, are fleeing after the fall of the Shah. So you're getting a group here that, you know, were upper middle class or people who ran the country, basically. Whereas in the case of the Jews and the Mormons, it's clearly rooted in their theology.
Yes, it's also important to emphasize that the qualities we're describing are open to anyone. There are many people not from these groups,
right,
who have all the qualities. You could get a sense of exceptionality from a parent. A parent could tell you a story about your family or some story about yourself. You could get this sense of exceptionality from many sources, but in these groups, it tends to come, as you're just pointing out, either from a religious source or from a historical civilizational narrative, or, as you were just saying, from the fact that the ones who come over to America enjoyed a higher status sometimes in their country than they do here.
And importantly, you're not saying, well, you can't make it if you didn't come from one of these groups. You are not saying that this is a package that we should be teaching in the schools or whatever. So it's not a formula for other groups. You're doing a descriptive analysis. Now, this superiority complex is tamed by its opposite, an inferiority complex. Tell us about that.
Well, we are calling it insecurity. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, there are many different sources of insecurity. And part of what is fascinating, I think, about the research is, you know, kind of seeing how these groups share this trait or this quality, but it comes from different reasons. You know, the reasons the Mormons have it is completely different from the reason that one of the other groups has it. We define insecurity as a sense, a fear or worry that, you know, you haven't quite done enough or you're not quite good enough yet. And this insecurity can come from being an immigrant. That almost by definition is to be insecure. You know, I don't know if I can survive in this country. I don't know if I'll ever be socially accepted. In the case of the Mormons, it comes from partly not being accepted by mainstream America. And I don't think I need to explain the source of Jewish insecurity, the whole history of persecution, the Holocaust. It's a fascinating thing. And the crux of the book is actually in the interaction between the superiority and, you know, sort of a sense of exceptionality with a dash of insecurity. And that's kind of what generates this chip on the shoulder or this goading drive or need to prove oneself, need to prove your, you know, show everyone.
But you might want to also mention the other source of insecurity, the family-driven source.
Yeah.
Yes, that's very important. So I just talked about insecurity vis-a-vis the rest of society. You know, yeah. I'm an outsider. But perhaps even more important, all of the groups we look at share this feature, and that is there's a kind of insecurity created within the family. Mm-hmm. In other words, to put it bluntly, parents making their children feel that they're not good enough yet. And this is something that runs against kind of mainstream American mantras. I mean, this is the opposite of the self-esteem movement. And this, you could see it in high expectations. And, you know, the parents like, an A- is not good enough yet. Your cousins are doing better than you. You're going to let the family down if you don't perform. So that's a family-based insecurity.
And you identify three sources of the insecurity: scorn, that is the outsider, fear of not being able to survive. Will there be enough food on the table, or will it all be taken away in the case of the Jews? And family, the need to redeem the sacrifices of the family. So together, these two create a synergy, the superiority complex and the insecurity and whatever resulting complexes come out of that. Now, Now, there's a third element, so let's talk about that. You call it impulse control.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, we define impulse control as the ability to resist temptation. And it could be the temptation to quit. So perseverance in the face of failure, overcoming adversity for us is part of impulse control, but habits of discipline. Now, there's just a wealth of empirical data out there that have already shown that, first of all, willpower or impulse control is something that can be taught and strengthened in people, especially kids. And then there's a wealth of data that shows that willpower is or impulse control is predictive of better outcomes in the conventional metrics of the kind we're looking at, educational, occupational, income, and so forth. I mean, everybody knows about the marshmallow test, right? So just to repeat it, they took kids who were 3, 4, 5 years old, put a marshmallow in front of them, said, you can eat up the marshmallow, or if you wait 15 minutes, we'll give you a second marshmallow. And most of the kids ate the first one right away. But about a third of the kids waited the full 15 minutes and got the second one. And the really remarkable part of the story is something the researchers stumbled on 20 years later. They didn't mean to do this, but they just happened to track the kids from the experiment. The ones who waited that 15 minutes were outperforming the others on every dimension. I mean, just remarkably so educationally in terms of how much money, their occupational prestige, stronger families, staying out of jail, less substance abuse. Now, this finding has been replicated time and time again all over the world. And there's something happening in the cultures of these immigrant groups, but also Mormons and Jews in America at this moment. Again, a snapshot, which somehow is strengthening through a combination of all three of these qualities, children's ability to defer gratification in that way, which is what we were talking about before. That's that orientation in time. Don't just do what you feel like doing now. Don't just grab that marshmallow. There's something more important. You've got to succeed. You have to wait. You have to get two marshmallows.
Now, as was already suggested, in each of these, they all can be overdone. So in other words, this is not a magic formula for everybody, A, but it also excess in any one of these dimensions can have really negative consequences. So it's the culture of the group that in some weird way creates a nice balance between all of these elements.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's very present often in the first generation, and, you know, it kind of gets eroded. And we chose these terms on purpose that were deliberately ambivalent. You know, as you say, a superiority complex taken to the extreme. I mean, we all know what a superiority complex has led to in history. Mm-hmm. Apartheid, slavery, the Holocaust in some ways. In some ways, the superiority complex, when it's in a minority group, used as a almost like an ethnic shield. So people are making fun of me, I'm being discriminated against, but my Iranian heritage, my pride being an Igbo Nigerian, is like a shield, can work as a shield against majority discrimination.
Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you're saying, well, this passes. This too will pass. So if we're looking at the fourth and fifth generations of these individuals, it may not be there. You quote some findings about Jewish achievement in some sort of a decline. And part of what's at work, and you have a nice profile of Ang Lee and Sal Bellow, one Jewish, one Taiwanese, and both of them essentially escape. And how do they do that? In other words, it's about transcending what you've become because of this triple package.
This is, in a way, almost what we wrote the book for. That is, this is the most exciting part of it, in our opinion. These triple package cultures or groups, they communicate this strength, this drive to their kids, but they also tend to communicate to them a very narrow set of expectations about what counts as success. But the second generation, as they grow up in America with American individualism and rebelliousness, they can break out of those expectations. They can start writing their own scripts. They can say, you know what, we're not so sure we accept your stories about how superior our group is, and we're not so sure we accept your idea of what counts as success. But you take those qualities that they got from their upbringing, and then they decide their own goals. In Ang Lee's case, filmmaker, Saul Bellow, writer. They were both looked down on by their parents, by their families, who didn't respect what they were doing, but they did it anyway, and they achieved a great deal because of intense perseverance, work ethic, drive to overcome all obstacles. And it's really, to us, a great case of the combination of America with these groups liberating the creative potential of both of those guys.
Go ahead.
Ong Lee is a great example of our book is not a celebration of the triple package or a celebration of conventional success, because the combination of the first two qualities, this kind of exceptionality with also insecurity, creates this feeling that you need to prove yourself. You're not good enough yet. And that is a very unpleasant feeling. In small doses, it could be a great motivator. In large doses, it can be crippling and incredibly depressing. And in Ong Lee's case, he's quite explicit about it, that he never felt he could please his father. And a great story that, as I think, says so much is after he won the Academy Award for Best Director, his father said, you know, well, you're still young. You could now be an academic. And, you know, so that's an example of never being able to satisfy, and also kind of the narrow vision of those, you know, that he wasn't an immigrant, but that kind of first-generation mentality of what counts as success can be very imprisoning for subsequent generations.
And we should make clear that by success, you're not covering all the good things that people can do in the world. You're talking about material success, academic achievement, prestige. Let's clarify that. Yeah.
Yes, we're looking at those very conventional metrics for about two-thirds of the book. I mean, success, in my view, just means achieving your goals, whatever those goals are. We focus on material wealth and these other conventional metrics for a few reasons. I mean, one, because it's something you can quantify, but two, because for a lot of people, that is a goal. And it's worth understanding how these people and these groups are communicating more of these behaviors and outlooks that enable their kids to achieve more of this conventional success. But at the end of the day, no, I mean, who needs to even say this, but income does not make you a good person. It's not. There are the values of morality, of decency. And then there are many different kinds of success. Now, we do use Ong Lee and Saul Bellow as examples that these same qualities can empower people to achieve success of very different kinds, not just, you know, making money in some conventional way, but being an artist if you choose, or something else.
I was struck by the extent to which, after reading the book carefully, that many of the reviews in the American press were a market indicator that the reviewer had not read the book. That's sort of what struck me. And so I want to, because of these reviews, I think it's important to emphasize what you're not saying. And you're not saying that, for example, the people in Appalachia who don't have the triple package, that's the reason they're poor and remain embedded in poverty. Talk about that.
Sure.
It's... Thank you for that. I mean, it's so prominent in our book that it's been a little bit of a shock. I mean, we say in the first chapter, in talking about African-American communities and Appalachia, that what we think are the original primary causes of poverty in this country are what you'd expect: slavery, discrimination, macroeconomic changes that wiped out the jobs of an entire region, denial of opportunity, you know, just kind of systematic things. And we put that kind of front and center. And, you know, just to give you an example, this is true in Appalachia, too. If you are a group that has been subjected to the majority kind of stamping a badge of inferiority on you, this is what white America did for most of its history on all its non-white populations, then it's actually much harder to have a superiority complex. But absolutely, the triple package has nothing to do, absolutely are not the causes of poverty at all.
And another, you know, a group you talk about as a counter case is the Amish people, who basically may have many of the qualities, but as a community choose to withdraw from the broader American context.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Now, one thing that the Amish have for sure is impulse control. I mean, habits of discipline and a whole code of things that they're not allowed to do. So they have that in spades. we think it's an interesting question whether the Amish have a superiority complex, because in the Amish understanding of their own community, they're humble, and they wouldn't dream of setting themselves up above others. But you kind of have to wonder whether there's a superiority of humility that might, in an interesting way, underlie that. But whichever way you go on that point, the key thing is, in security, they don't care how Americans view them. They have successfully, and you got to give them credit for this, they have isolated themselves, and in their fundamentalist faith, found security in their faith, in their own ways, and it's just not of importance to them whether Americans think they're strange or kooky or Christian or not Christian or what we think of them, because they have just isolated themselves and withdrawn and turned away from that kind of economic insecurity. That is, oh, they have money problems, but it's not a matter of like their identity that Americans might think that they're not doing well enough. That's not their issue. And we found that this is true in fundamentalist religious communities all over the country. So there are fundamentalist Mormons who are not succeeding today, and they are you see the same phenomenon. They are isolated, withdrawn. In fact, they broke away from the mainstream Mormon church 100 years ago when the church renounced polygamy. So these guys still practice polygamy, but the same thing. They find their security in their faith, their practices, and they reject the standards, the values of the rest of society. One of the poorest towns in the entire United States is Kiryas Yoel, which is a little bit north of Manhattan, which is a Satmar Orthodox Jewish community. Now, they have the same thing. They've turned away. They're not insecure vis-a-vis the rest of the society. They're actually very big into education. You know, a lot of people think you can explain the success of various groups in terms of an education culture. These Orthodox Jews are very big into education, but they are not interested in making money to prove anything to themselves or others.
Now, your book is focused on a particular time in the story of these groups, but it's also implicitly commenting on the United States itself and the broader context. And you begin by saying, well, hey, America was a triple package nation. Talk a little about that, and then we'll go on from there.
So it's actually almost like a paradigm case. You know, America, American exceptionalism is almost a trope. Everybody knows about that. You know, this feeling that city on a hill, we have a better system, and we're going to, you know, so that the sense of superiority based on equality and opportunity. At the same time, even from the founding, America always had, or for most of its history, the insecurity of being the underdog. Our founding fathers had such a chip on their shoulder vis-a-vis aristocratic Europe that held itself out as richer, more cultured. Thomas Jefferson actually sent a giant moose carcass to France to show that we had bigger animals. And of course, we always had rivals throughout our history. I'll get to that later. Impulse control, you know, we forget about this now. I mean, if you just read Ben Franklin's Proverbs, they're all about thrift and perseverance and frugality and discipline. This is the Calvinist, the Puritan ethic. So that was in the book, we kind of only bookend it. We're saying, like, in many sense, America has, these are the triple package values, are very, very traditional American values.
But if I could add one thing, it's so interesting, and we discussed this in the last chapter of our book. If you look at America's two foundational documents, the Constitution on the one hand and the Declaration of Independence on the other, there's really an interesting tension which most of us don't know about, don't see. The Declaration of Independence captured America's rebellious, anti-authoritarian, individualist streak, the kind of live-in-the-moment side of America, because what it was declaring independence, breaking free, we'll govern ourselves. And it was about the pursuit of happiness. And then there was about 10 years of almost chaos and anarchy and insurrections and the question of what happens if we have majority tyranny in the United States. Democracy opened up a new problem in political theory, majority tyranny. And so what are we going to do if there's insurrections or rebellions? Well, that's the people doing it. Does that mean there's nothing to be done? What if the people rise up and start persecuting religious minorities? So the framers of the Constitution figured out that the only solution to that problem, while respecting the idea of democracy, of popular sovereignty, was the people had to agree to restrain themselves, to tie their hands behind their back, and say, we agree through this document not to violate people's religious freedom, not to violate these other rights which we're going to lay down as fundamental. In other words, impulse control, an act of tying yourself to the mast like Ulysses and the Sirens. And the fascinating thing there is America has always had, we think, these triple package values along with this rebellious, creative, individualist streak, which has, we think, over the centuries really created a lot of drive and innovation and creativity. But in recent years, the kind of live in the moment, immediate gratification side has started to trump a little bit, we think, and some of the triple package values have maybe gotten a little eroded.
And is this a case of excess? In other words, coming to think too well of itself, combined, interestingly enough, with an increased insecurity, say after 9/11, which leads to an unbalance, because the notion in your description of the groups and the individual is of a balance, you know. Whereas one can argue that in some ways, when you look at the nation, there has been an imbalance, which you know may come from the assertion of too much executive authority or from too much prosperity. Are you playing with that? Is that in the back of your mind?
Very much so. I mean, I have written about hyperpowers, and it's interesting, for all of the United States history until the fall of the Soviet Union, we were either the underdog or we had some major rivals.
Yeah.
And that kind of kept you on your toes, you know. And after the fall of the former Soviet Union, for the first time, we had no rival. Around the same time in the 80s and 90s, of course, we saw these just kind of hedge fund, you know, enormous wealth explosion, more concentrated at the top, but this is the bonfire of the vanities. And I think in a way it was success itself that erodes the sense of insecurity at the time, you know, and that can lead to sitting on your laurels, a little complacency. I think we never lost the superiority complex, mm-hmm. but as you say, we've always, that needs to be kind of balanced by this insecurity. And certainly it's terrible when bad things happen, but in a perverse way, the 9/11 and the financial crisis and the unwon wars and just things have not gone well, maybe the rise of China may have reignited a little bit more insecurity in the United States, and could be almost like a blessing in disguise. You know, like we need to shape up a little bit, take a look at ourselves.
Now, you point out in the book, interestingly enough, that to one of the problems is the alternative packages that are out there. You are not selling a package, namely a formula to save America. But there have been people out there who have, and one of them, one of the arguments is that our children need self-esteem, basically.
Yes.
And so, and you criticize that. I mean, embedded in this work is a real critique of where we are.
I think the opposite. When I say that the first two elements of the triple package produce this need to prove yourself, you know, you're not good enough yet, which at its extreme can be quite negative. But this need to prove yourself, which can generate drive, is the exact opposite of being entitled. And that is, in some ways, what the self-esteem movement has created. That is, if you tell somebody, you are perfect, you're amazing, you don't need to earn it, you know, you can have it, you come, you get a trophy, you are, there's nothing you need to do. That kind of entitlement, we do critique. You know, in some ways, while the book is not a how-to, I guess you could say we're giving these extremes. You know, one, you're never good enough. That's not such a great formula either, but it can generate drive. At the other extreme, you are absolutely perfect and you don't have to do anything. That's not such a great position to be in either. Because
And there's data that's backing this up now. I mean, people have studied this, and the findings are remarkable. I mean, as you say, we're not advocating that anybody should, you know, follow this as a how-to book. On the contrary, but Asian Americans repeatedly score the lowest on self-esteem scales, even as they're doing better. Asian American students, lowest on the self-esteem scales, even while they're doing better than other students. This just flew in the face of about 30 years of educational theory, which was the more self-esteem you felt, the better you should do. So people started doing controlled tests where they took a class of college students, and half of them they started sending self-esteem boosting messages to, and the other half got a message from, you know, it was a control group, got a message, but it had none of the self-esteem boosting things in it. The ones who got the self-esteem boosting message did worse, not better. And so they're doing these experiments, and they're finding that contrary to the expectations of the self-esteem movement, it hasn't produced the results that were expected. So I do think you're right. That is a place where we have a critical view, and I think the data bear it out.
Now you are both lawyers, law professors, yet you're using a lot of social science data to contribute to the public discourse. So what are the challenges in the first part of that, namely the use of all of the social science data, and to put it together in a package and meaningfully explain what it means, basically?
Yeah, well, I mean, both Amy and I are trained as lawyers, and we, you know what lawyers do? They're trained to look at complex fact patterns and statistics and try to understand the underlying causes. And then to try sometimes to have good policy ideas. I mean, this is how we, at least in our, this is how we think that we are trying to teach our students at Yale Law School. And that's all we're doing in this book. I mean, I think that the book is very data-driven. I mean, as you say, we put in all the footnotes and endnotes, and we invite people, if you doubt any of the facts we're putting out here, look at our footnotes, and you'll see that they're verified. And then it's a question, so you have the data, you do serious, empirical, rigorous, data-driven research, and then it's a question of interpreting the data and trying to understand what the data are telling you. So I think that's open to anybody. You know, once the data are there, then we should all be able to have a conversation about it. And when you said a moment ago that what we were trying to do is start a conversation, you know, I want to emphasize that is exactly right. And it has been painful to us, the extent to which some people have tried to, like, shut that conversation down, like you're not allowed to talk about cultural differences in this country. How can that be? You can't say, for example, the following statement. Asian American kids' study habits are, at least in part, responsible for their better academic performance. That's cultural racism? If so, we're in big trouble. We're not going to be able to understand inequality. We're not going to be able to understand poverty reduction programs. I mean, and yet there are a lot of people out there saying that, oh, you're not supposed to say these things. And we just felt, look, the facts are out there. Calling the facts racist isn't going to change them. The only way to change the facts is going to be to face them. And if we want to level the playing field, if we want to do something, we need to understand what's happening in the world.
So how do you explain the misinterpretation? Amy must be an expert on this, as the tiger mom personified in quotes. What is it about our public discourse that doesn't allow you to put ideas out on the table with subtlety, with humor, and instead they you know are viciously attacked or misinterpreted, or essentially prevented from informing a public discourse?
I've just been thinking about maybe this should be the next book. Because it's happened twice to me. Obviously, whenever you talk about groups and cultures, there are real dangers that we acknowledge. You know, we write about the importance of not stereotyping. But I do think it's a problem when you can't just state a simple fact or, these behaviors lead to this. If you can't talk about things like that, I mean, it's really going to be challenging to develop good policy. Part of it could be, I think maybe political correctness has just gone a little far. I think a lot of people, when we talk about immediate gratification, I think a lot of people want to have an opinion and jump in and say things without having read anything. It's so interesting, to me as an academic, to see people reviews that actually say, "I haven't read the book, but based on a review I read, I have these incredibly critical things to say." So it's
So you've worked in different genres. I mean, you've written political history and almost social science. You've written novels and legal treatises, and I'm sure you've written a lot of legal scholarship. So where is the best place to make arguments?
It's so interesting. They're so different. You know, you're right. I have written a couple of novels, and I tried to make arguments in those books. And what was liberating about making an argument in a novel is you don't have to provide any evidence or support because you can just throw something out there and there are no checks on it. Now, in this book, we thought we were providing all the data, all the backup. There is not one sentence in that book where we make an assertion about a group's outcomes, their attitudes, their behaviors that aren't backed up by empirical studies of a variety of kinds. And we thought that was going to do it and insulate us and enable us to make these arguments. The reaction, the early reaction to the book, before it was even published, before anyone had read it, now I think has made both Amy and me wonder about how we can have this kind of conversation, because if we can't have a frank conversation about groups and group differences and culture in America, it just seems like, you know, we've been fighting poverty for 50 years and more. We've been throwing millions and millions of dollars at education programs. You get a laptop for every kid. What if that's not the way to go? What if instead, as Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman has argued, that education dollars for the underprivileged are much more efficiently and better spent on early education programs, not by getting them a laptop, but by getting in there when they're 3 and 4 years old and working with the families to try to teach motivation, perseverance, and other characterological and behavioral traits early on. He says he's found by studying the data out there that that's where you get the most productive results.
I think that one really sad possible consequence of this making culture or talking about groups taboo is that it actually cedes that incredibly important territory to extremists and ideologues. There are plenty of people who are making statements about groups and cultures. And I feel like it's a terrible mistake for honest kind of progressives to say, no, this part we're just going to cut out. We can't talk about this. It's all going to be institutions and discrimination, which we deeply believe in. I mean, that is a major part. But I feel like you're just like they're slicing one important piece of the picture out and ceding it to others who might not treat it as subtly.
Well, on that note, I think our time is up, and I want to thank you both. And I want to advise our readers to not only go out and buy the book, but to actually read it. So thank you very much, Amy and Jed, for being here today. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.